This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Eric Berman is the State House Bureau Chief for the Network Indiana and radio station WIBC News team in Indianapolis. He's a veteran reporter and a correspondent, keeping a very close eye for decades on what the General Assembly does and politics in general in Indiana. And Eric, I know that one of the things you're watching these days very closely is whenever they decide to come back to work on it will be what the lawmakers do about drawing some new legislative districts, and you spent some time and put some stories out about it.
Yeah, because what's fascinating here is, remember, the candidate filing starts in January, and in fact it ends in February. So if you're going to run for Congress or for the General Assembly, you've only got that 30-day period to file your candidacy. And the problem is, if you're going to run for the General Assembly, you have to live in your district, which is logical enough. And they're not going to know what those districts are until that redistricting is done, which, because of the delays at the census, is not going to be until September or October. So there's going to be a very short window in terms of knowing who's eligible to run. You can try to recruit candidates and then potentially have the lines draw them out of their district.
Now, let me ask you in a moment here about what the state's Democratic and Republican leadership have to say about all this coming up here. But one of the things I know that has come to this point now is that there's been a bipartisan, a very seriously bipartisan group set up, the Citizens' Reelection, Citizens' Redistricting Commission, as it's called, that has been very seriously looking into this and making sure that citizens have a say in all this. Can you tell us a little bit, if you can, about the setup of the commission and what they have come up to now that the lawmakers are going to be taking a look at?
Well, I don't think the lawmakers, honestly, are going to take much of a look at it, quite frankly. But what they've done is interesting. It's essentially a shadow redistricting commission, what they have done. And they here is Common Cause of Indiana, and I believe the League of Women Voters, and some other good government watchdog groups. They've been arguing for years that there should be an independent redistricting commission, as several states have, rather than legislators drawing their own districts. And what they have done is they've put together their own commission saying, okay, this is how this would work. We can put together a bipartisan independent commission, and we can show you what that process would look like. And once we have data, we plan to draw maps and show you what we consider a fair and nonpartisan map would look like. There has not been appetite in the legislature to do that. More precisely, there used to be appetite, but never both parties at the same time. Whoever's been in the majority has suddenly discovered that they like being able to draw the maps, and when the majority shifted from Democrats to Republicans in the House, suddenly it was the Democrats who wanted a commission and the Republicans who thought this could be put off. There are some exceptions, but basically the majority of the majority party has said, no, we think that the existing system is good enough.
Now, speaking of that, I know you had a chance to speak with both Indiana Democratic Party Chairman Mike Schmuel and with Republican State Chairman Kyle Hupfer about this. What do the chairs of the respective parties have to think about it?
They're rolling with the punches. They're acknowledging that it's a little bit of a challenge and not knowing where the district lines are going to be. But they say that, first off, you've got kind of a general idea. I mean, we know that parts of Lake County have been losing population. We know that the donut counties around Indianapolis have been gaining population. There are other trends that where you may not know the precise numbers, but you have a general idea how some of those districts may shift. And so they can make some plans in advance, and if it turns out that somebody suddenly becomes ineligible to run for a seat, well, as Mike Schmuel said, you know, there's other ways to contribute to the party. Even if you can't run for the seat that you thought you'd run for, you can run for a different one. You can run for a local office rather than for the legislature. You can assist the party behind the scenes in party building activities. There's lots of things you can do. So they publicly, at least, they say they're not overly concerned about it, but it does complicate their job a little bit.
Now staying on the local and county levels, as you have, let's talk about what kind of impact all this might have, and especially if candidates finally decide, or they've discovered, I should say, that they're no longer in the district that they hope to run for, and they have to make some changes, like you mentioned that Chairman Schmuel is suggesting. What kind of impact is going to have on the local folks that have to set up the elections?
I'm not sure it's going to affect the local clerk's offices all that much. You know, mm-hmm. By the time this all sorts out, the ballots don't have to be printed, actually can't be printed until the candidates have filed. So their deadlines are a little bit different and won't be any different from any other year. Once candidate filing closes at the beginning of February, then there's a challenge period where people can claim that somebody doesn't live in the district or isn't really a Republican or Democrat or what have you. There's lots of grounds for challenges, and some of them get upheld. And then once the ballot is finalized, that's when the clerk's offices go to work getting ready. So they probably, I would not anticipate a lot of problems at that level other than waiting for the legislature to tell them, okay, so which precinct gets which ballot.
We're talking with veteran State House reporter and bureau chief for the State House for Network Indiana and WIBC Radio in Indianapolis, Eric Berman. And he's sat through enough General Assembly sessions to know how lawmakers work for many, many years. And he, in particular, is also watching, like we all are, how the redistricting of the districts will take place when the 2021 General Assembly slips back in off their summer vacation and gets to work. We know we talk here about the state legislative districts. Let's talk about the congressional seats, because that's part of the redistricting process. How do things shape up as far as the way that the congressional districts will look whenever they finish up their work on redistricting?
Well, it's going to be fascinating. I mean, there's two. First off, Indiana's not losing any seats, so we caught a break there. That was expected, but still always good news. So 9 U.S. House seats, same as before, but those have to be redrawn, and the lines will shift. And I think there's agreement between Kyle Hupfer and Mike Schmuel that the two districts to keep an eye on are the 5th District, the suburban Indianapolis district, represented by Victoria Spartz, a Republican, and right up in your backyard, Frank Mervan's district in the 1st District. The 5th was the closest race, not just in the last election, but the closest congressional race that we've had in 8 years. So that is a district that has shifted towards becoming more swingy. But when you get to redraw the lines, Republicans will control the process, and they'll undoubtedly be looking to make it maybe a little bit less swingy, to shore up Victoria Spartz somewhat. Democrats mm-hmm. have their eye on that district. Where the lines are going to make a difference. The fascinating one to me is, again, Representative Mervan. Like Victoria Spartz, a freshman, elected to his first term in November. And that is a district, as you know, that the Democrats have held since 1932. No Republican has won that in more than 90 years. But a couple of the national forecasters who keep an eye on this are saying this is a district that could really be reshaped by redistricting. What Kyle Hupfer, the state Republican chairman, is saying is we think even without redistricting, it's trending more Republican. The election last year when Representative Mervan beat Mark Leyva, that's the closest race you've had in the first district in 26 years. Now, a couple of caveats. Close in this case means 16 points. It was not particularly close. And 26 years ago, if you do the math, that was the Gingrich wave in 94 when Republicans won a bunch of seats and came surprisingly close in some seats that they'd never done well in for years. So that election was something of an outlier, but still closest one since then. If you can close it to 16 points, then can you close it even further? Mark Leyva actually carried Porter County, the Porter County portion of the district, narrowly, but he carried it. So it's one that Republicans have their eyes on. And depending on where those lines go, can you bring in enough Republican territory to make that more competitive than it's been basically for decades? And that's something that the process will answer.
So, as you mentioned, we're having to look to what happens in the 1st Congressional District, our district up here, and the 5th District down in central Indiana to see what changes are going to come about. Are there any other districts that are likely to maybe go by the wayside as far as keeping an eye on them because they're not seeing the changes as much as what we're expecting?
I don't think there are any others that are likely. Certainly those are the two that are drawing the most attention. If I had to pick a third place one, it would be the one right next door to Representative Mervan, Jackie Walorski's district mm-hmm. in the second. When I said Representative Spartz had the closest race in 8 years, Representative Walorski's first election in 2012 was the last one that was closer. That was a district that had been redrawn to make it more Republican. Remember, she ran a very close race against Joe Donnelly in 2010, lost it. They redrew the district. Joe Donnelly ran for the Senate and won. And in the open seat, Jackie Walorski won it by a very narrow margin. She's won comfortably ever since. That's a volatile enough district, potentially. You know, if you'd redraw the lines, particularly if you redraw the first to give Frank Mervan a little bit more trouble, potentially, you know, there's only so many voters. And if you take them, if you put them into one district, you're taking them out of another, and vice versa. And so whatever they do in the first, whatever they do, period, and in particular, if they try to redraw the first in a more Republican way, that affects the second. They always talk about sharpening their pencils, and these days when the pencils are software that can spit out a million bits of information in a microsecond, they can draw it pretty precisely. But if there's another one that might be a little tough, that's probably the one.
Well, Eric, we're just going to all have to wait and see what comes about when the General Assembly comes back off their summer vacation, gets back to work, and deals with the drawing of the district maps for the lawmakers in Indianapolis as well as around the state with the Congress. And thanks for spending time to go over this and offering your insight today.
Chris, always a pleasure.
Eric Berman is a veteran State House reporter. He's the bureau chief for the State House for Network Indiana and Indianapolis radio station WIBC. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing with our Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, we have with us Post-Tribune freelance reporter Carol Carlson to talk about the stories that she's put out in print and online recently. And Carol, thanks for joining us on the show again.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the interesting stories you have is about a place called Recovery Cafe. It's nestled in a quiet little, well, as quiet as you'd expect Broadway in Merrillville to be along the highway, but a very, very nice place where people get a great opportunity to have a meal if they have certain problems, and yet they get some peer support to go along with that meal as well. Tell us more about what the Liberty House Recovery Cafe is all about.
It's a ambitious venture, and it is nestled in a shopping mall on Merrillville. Probably a lot of people remember it. There's a police substation within the strip mall at 5400 block of Broadway.
Yeah, they just opened that up. They just opened it up recently. It's been in the planning stages for a long time, I know, but finally got opened.
Right, and the Recovery Cafe is a part of a national network. It began in Seattle close to 2 decades ago, and its aim is to provide peer support for people struggling with addictions or any myriad of problems that people are struggling with today, mental health problems, systemic racism problems, any kind of abuse problems. And they're there just to listen to you and to contribute to your well-being. And right now they're open 3 days a week in this portion of the strip mall that Heritage Christian Church has donated the space. It's being operated by the City Refuge Christian Church in Portage right now. And it's open to anybody who wants to show up, and the membership is free.
I understand the pastor and his wife are very much involved in this.
They are. Pastor Michael Pirtle and his wife Linda. Linda is the house manager. And the only thing members have to do is come to the meetings sober. I don't know if I should call them meetings. They're more like get-togethers. Folks come in and you sit at tables in the cafe and you get a meal. If you'd like, there are board games available just to engage people and to get people talking. And once a week, they have what they call recovery circles, in which Linda, for example, will lead a discussion and just to get people talking.
I understand that they were also looking for volunteers, and I know it's volunteers within, I guess, the group, but also from outside volunteers as well.
Yeah, they're looking for volunteers like many other nonprofits, and you can, if you're interested, you can come and just help serve the meals from the kitchen, or you can help facilitate the discussions. You can pretty much write your own ticket and do whatever you'd like to do.
I understand this is supported by a group out of Indianapolis. So if they're doing well in Indianapolis and they've come up here to Northwest Indiana, what do the folks in Indianapolis in state government have to think about this?
Well, the mother organization for the Recovery Cafe in Indiana is called We Bloom. It's a nonprofit that's been around for a little bit, and they've got other nonprofits under their wing. And they have successfully started one in Indianapolis that's been fondly received. They have one in Lafayette and Muncie and Rochester, Indiana. And Merrillville is the fifth one in their Indiana roster of recovery cafes.
That's interesting. Obviously, in your story, you mentioned about the fact that Gary Mayor Jerome Prince even came out from his hometown and came over to visit. What's he think about this Recovery Cafe
idea?
Yeah,
well, when you think about it, this location is just 3 blocks from Gary, and certainly a lot of Gary residents would avail themselves of it. And Prince is 100% behind it for obvious reasons. You know, helping people recover from whatever issues in their lives is a good thing for the citizenry, whether it be Merrillville, Gary, Hobart, anywhere.
That's great. We're talking with Post-Tribune freelance reporter Carol Carlson about her stories in print online recently. One of the stories as well deals with a topic that has come up before in the city of Gary. It's trying to deal with a way to get rid of gang violence and try and whittle away at the poverty problem. And this way it's involving, I understand, a youth summit. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, Gary, this is the city of Gary, sponsored its first youth summit that they've had under Mayor Prince, and it drew students from all the different middle schools and high schools in Gary, as well as Lake Ridge, which is just outside of Gary, and they came together just to told the elected officials and city officials at the summit what is on their mind right now, whether it be problems with gangs or violence or mental health issues. A lot of students had some really insightful questions, you know, what to do during the pandemic when you're stuck at home trying to learn remote and you're isolated and you miss your friends, and what kind of resources are out there for you, and they covered a lot of issues that I think were important to talk about.
That's good. What reaction has come from the mayor's office about how the initiative is going so far?
They were very excited about it, and they're looking forward to having a follow-up summit in which they can more deeply address some of the students' needs. That, you know, not knowing what the questions were going to be, now they can actually look into them more and perhaps provide better, stronger resources to meet the students' needs.
One of your other stories that you have out in print and online from the Post-Tribune talks about the pandemic and talks about recovery from the pandemic, which we are starting to see now with the more vaccinations and the like. And it's a way, I guess, to try to bring young people back into school on a nice basis. That is, to remind them of what the springtime proms are all about. Tell us about what you found out and how some of the school districts here in Northwest Indiana are dealing with the class of 21 and their proms.
Finally, we have some kind of semblance of normalcy in high schools, and those poor kids in the class of 2020 had to lose so much at the end of their high school careers. They lost proms and graduations and assemblies where they would receive honors for their high school careers. This year, most schools are taking steps to hold proms, and almost all of them, I haven't come across any that aren't holding the traditional commencement services. The proms were kind of fun and interesting. Lake Station, for example, did a survey amongst their students. They didn't want to do the traditional formal prom. They wanted to do something along an alternative, safer nature. And students had a choice of whether going to one of those go-kart places or drive-in movie or having a sort of a prom with a movie at their own football field, and they chose to go to their football field and watch a movie.
How'd that turn out?
Go ahead.
How'd that turn out?
I think they had a great time. I haven't spoken to the principal. The prom was just this past Saturday, and she said that the students, there was no contest when it came from them selecting which venue they wanted to do. They wanted to stay at their own school and be on their own football field and enjoy the night with their peers.
I know you talked with folks in Lake Station as the students there, and you checked a few other school districts out, in particular in Porter County. What'd you find out?
Porter County was a little bit, well, not a little bit, they were more traditional. They followed COVID protocols, but they had their proms like a normal prom. One was at Wheeler High School, went to the County Line Orchard, and Valparaiso High School held their prom at the Porter County Expo Center. And the COVID protocols remained in place, social distancing and mask wearing for the most part, I think, and no problems were reported. In Hobart, they decided to be a little bit safer and keep the prom at their school gym mm-hmm. and in their field house area. And they offered a meal right there on site and did not charge an admission fee. And that was sponsored by the National Honor Society. And they even had dance areas marked with duct tape to keep people from coming close to each other and able to keep their social distance.
Well, I guess there has to be some concession, unfortunately, to the pandemic and making sure that the protocols are followed to be sure. And this is an interesting situation here where you have the school's National Honor Society that's decided to host the event here. Usually, I'm sure they probably go in the past to other outside organizations for help, but and the school district, of course, does what it can. But it's just something stretching forward where everybody's trying to find a way to be able to bring things back to this new normal, to be sure.
I think the kids are pretty happy with what they got this year. And I spoke to one of the students at Hobart High School. She was just a freshman. And I asked her why she was there helping decorate since she's just a freshman and she would not be allowed to go to the prom. And she said because her sister is a senior and she remembered how sad her sister was last year when she could not go to the prom as a junior. And she wanted to make it the best prom she could for her older sister.
Well, that's great to hear. And Carol, thank you for spending time with us to tell us about these stories, and we hope to see some more coming up soon.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris.
You're welcome. Carol Carlson's a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune, and you are listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's talk with Joseph Pete, who's a business reporter and writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joseph, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
We've got a number of good stories that are out there and a few stories that are not business-related, which shows that everybody at the newspaper has to help out and cover stories from time to time. And, in fact, the first one we got up here is a sad story, but story that has, I think, captivated a lot of attention, certainly in the last week or so, ever since a young lad, an autistic boy from Kansas City, had suddenly disappeared. Tell us about that, and if you will, fill us in on the outcome.
Yes, Kyron Carter, a 12-year-old autistic boy from Kansas City, was visiting the area to visit his family. He was staying at the Best Western Hotel by the Little Calumet River in Hammond. Unfortunately, he went missing. This prompted a massive manhunt by more than 25 law enforcement agencies and hundreds, it's estimated more than 1,000 volunteers from all across Northwest Indiana and beyond. The people came up from downstate to help. The story resonated with a lot of people. A lot of people felt for the kid and for his parents, but a lot of the volunteers had autistic children or, you know, could really relate and understand. He was a nonverbal boy. He was left, he left in his shorts and without wearing shoes. He was unfortunately very drawn to the water. It turned out they had security footage that showed him kind of sprinting toward the water. He did it the day before, and his grandmother had caught him in that instance. But the second time, unfortunately, she was asleep and wasn't able to catch him. It was, but there was a massive manhunt along the Little Calumet River. I went out myself like several times. People were looking along the riverbanks, but the police deployed helicopters, dive teams, submarine drones, boats with sonar. They went searching on horseback in the area. There was just a massive presence of both volunteers. Some of the volunteers I had talked to, you know, started looking at like 2 in the morning when they got off their shift. and went, you know, we're out there for nearly like 24 hours at a stretch. There's just this desperate hunt to try to find the poor child. And unfortunately, they ultimately did. It took a feat of engineering, something they had never done before. They decided to stop the flow of the Little Calumet River. At Hart Ditch, it breaks off in two directions. Goes west toward Illinois and east toward Gary and then Burns Harbor. It empties out into Lake Michigan. And they decided to dam the river at Indianapolis Boulevard. They put in like steel pilings, secured it in a place with clay, and they managed to sort of drain the, stop the new flow of river coming in, because it's pretty deep in that area. It's 15, you know, it's shallow in a lot of parts, but it's about 15 to 27 feet there by the hotel, and it's incredibly turbid and murky, and there's a lot of particulates floating in there, and it was very difficult, because the area where he was ultimately found by a kayaker, an outdoorsman from Hoburg, who assisted in the search, they had been to that area multiple times. Canine units had led police there, dive teams had searched. But when you're searching, you know, every square inch of a 7-foot river, where you can't see, you know, a foot in front of you, it's very, very difficult. When they drained the river, it was able to lower the water level enough and kind of clear the water level enough where a kayaker was eventually able to find him to give, you know, some closure to the family, but it was just a horrible, horrible tragedy. And, you know, there was a massive search for 10 days. If there was any silver lining, it was just people coming together to try and help the family and the kid. But it was just a horrible loss of life, unfortunately.
I know that it's tragedies like this and emergencies that pop up like this that you hope that city government can do the best to help people out. And we certainly know that in this case that Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. and his staff, as well as his agencies and the city government in Hammond, did their best to try and help find the boy. And that was, as you mentioned before, a lot of the work they did in damming the Little Calumet River so that the level would be low enough they could actually do a better search was all something very important. But I understand, too, that the mayor said that he wanted to be sure that the family members knew first before anybody else about the outcome.
Oh, absolutely. There was a lot of interest in the case on social media. And one thing they were kind of unhappy with was that they were getting all of these, there were people who were posting on Facebook all these, like, sightings that turned out to be spurious, where people, you know, allegedly had seen him in Highland or seen him biking in Hoburg or things of that nature. And the family was trying to cling on to any, you know, any thread of hope they could grab onto, because it was, you know, the two options as the days drug on were either that he was in the river or that he had been abducted. And they were kind of almost perversely hoping he had been abducted, because that would have meant he was still alive. But there was a lot of static over the course of the investigation. They had a lot of, like, psychics calling in and telling police to search in these vague areas because they had a dream and things of that nature. But there was, Mayor McDermott said the city was going to absolutely spare no expense to make sure that the child was found. They didn't even consider stopping the search. They just, you know, they wanted to just, you know, be able to bring the family closure. They'd actually called in the FBI, and an FBI dive team was scheduled to come in before the day after the kayaker had found Kyron Carter. Mm-hmm. But the mayor was saying there was, he wanted to ensure that the family heard it from him first, and then they made a point of sending search teams out like first thing in the morning, because they were worried that as the water level was lowering, you know, a biker, a bicyclist or a jogger or someone might come across the body, and they just wanted to break the sad and tragic news to the family firsthand to make sure it's handled in a, you know, delicate and, you know, sensitive and empathetic way.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Joseph Pete of The Times about the stories he's put out in print and online, and have a couple stories that are related to the pandemic. One good news about more vaccines that are available and another walk-in clinic that's opened up. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. Methodist hospitals in Gary and Maryville have now, it was appointment only pretty much they first got the vaccine, but now they'll accept patients on a walk-in basis. That's between, I believe, 7 a.m. and 6 or 7 a.m. and 4 p.m. Monday through Saturday. You can just walk in at any time to either of the hospitals and get the Pfizer vaccine. I believe
according to the Illinois Department of Public Health, it's something like 95% effective at preventing people from contracting and spreading the coronavirus that killed more than 600,000 Americans, more than 3.5 million people worldwide at this point. More and more places are, and that's available to anyone who's over the age of 12 because this is the Pfizer one. More and more places are now accepting walk-ins, including, I believe, Walmart and CVS. And more and more places have also opened it up to at locations, at least where they have the Pfizer vaccine. The children over 12 can come in now, so long as they have the consent of a parent and get vaccinated. So it's becoming more and more accessible. I think nationwide, it's something like half the public has been vaccinated. But some of the experts were saying, you know, you need kind of 75% to reach the herd immunity to where we can put this horrible pandemic past us and kind of be able to move on.
One of the coronavirus pandemic-related stories that you have, and it's back to business news here. It's about the problem that we've heard about before. In fact, a couple stories, one in particular about how the pandemic and the semiconductor shortage it was messing up everything as far as new vehicles are concerned. But we shouldn't even, don't even think about used cars. But even the dealers are having trouble trying to keep those cars on the lot. Tell us about that story, please.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it's we have the Chicago assembly plant in Haguish is shut down this week again because of the semiconductor. And in early June, it's going to be running at like limited capacity with I think only one line going. But it's there's so many supply chains have been disrupted as a result of this pandemic. We've had shortages of everything from flour to toilet paper to cleaning supplies. You name it, it's just constantly. There's even one of the drive-ins is out of root beer because they can't get the ingredients. But one of the more impactful ones has been semiconductors or, the microchips, which are mainly, manufactured abroad. But the there's been this worldwide shortage of them. It was largely as a result of the auto plants cut back on production. When the pandemic started, they had no idea how long it was going to last. And then there was a surge in demand, though, because more people were home. So more people were buying video game consoles. Computers and the automakers ended up falling to the back of the line when they started putting in orders again. The chip factories are unable to ramp up production enough to satisfy all the demand. So cars plants across the country have been temporarily shutting down because they lack the microchips. And cars have gotten more technologically sophisticated in recent years where they rely on a lot of semiconductors. You have lane assist, you have parallel parking assist, you have rear view cameras, you have all this like newfangled safety technology where it's very high tech and it requires, a lot of microchips. So they haven't been able to have enough continue making vehicles. It's expected that production is going to be of new vehicles will be down anywhere from 1 million to 4 million units this year. That's huge. And, a lot of the new car dealers, they don't have the inventory they're used to having. They don't have the inventory they're used to having, and they've been forced to sell kind of used cars. Instead, I've been told that places that normally sold one used car for every one new car are now selling three used cars for every new car. People are just moving to the used car market because that's all that's available. The new car dealers are so desperate to have inventory on their lots. They've even been buying used cars from used car lots. If you drive around the region and you look at some of the smaller kind of used car lots, like some of them are completely cleared out. Some of them are completely empty right now.
Wow.
You might have just a couple of vehicles left. The prices at auction have been shooting up. They hit a record in April, and they've been growing even more in May so far. And it's been very difficult for car dealers to procure used vehicles. The prices have been rising wholesale. Obviously, they have to pass that on to consumers. They've been saying, it's they're paying thousands more at auction, and they've just had a hard time keeping inventory in stock, and it's not expected to get any better until maybe next year at the earliest, because until the new car vehicle production picks up enough, they're not going to be able to have enough new cars to satisfy demand, and there's still going to be people are going to be clamoring for used cars. The only plus side is if you have a vehicle you're looking to unload, or you're never going to get a better trade-in value apparently than right now. It's trading in or selling your car. You're in a definitely a seller's market right now.
And one of the other stories you have that's auto-related that's out there in print online in the Times is the news about another a big auto group that is keeping an eye on Northwest Indiana business. In fact, has acquired some of the local dealerships. Tell us about Ziegler Automotive Group, where they're from, and what they're taking on now as their business in Northwest Indiana.
Yes, Ziegler Automotive Group is based in Kalamazoo, Michigan. They're one of the largest automotive groups in the country. They have 76 franchises and 31 dealerships that they own directly. They own multiple ones in the Chicagoland area, particularly in the Orland Park and Schaumburg markets. They're all over the suburbs. I think they have something close to 20 dealerships in the Chicago area. They've had a couple in Indiana, both in Elkhart, but they've had success and growth in Indiana over the past 15 years or so. So they've been looking to expand, and they bought the Infiniti Subaru dealership in Merrillville, and they pretty much have big plans for it. They are going to do a major investment, greatly increase the size of the dealership, increase the showroom, increase the inventory. They're looking to add staff on both service and sales. They've already started to hire more people for it, but they're looking to definitely grow. They've targeted Northwest Indiana's growth market. They're interested in potentially acquiring or opening more dealerships here in the future, but they're a pretty big player in the automotive retail industry, and it's their first Subaru dealership, and it's their first entree into the Northwest Indiana market. You have seen a lot of dealerships changing hands too recently. There's been dealerships in Michigan City, Highland, Burnt Harbor, all over Northwest Indiana, where there have been a lot of sales, and the landscape has really been changing with that in the past 18 to 24 months or so.
Have to wait and see what kind of impact this is going to have on the new car and the used car of inventory that comes out there with these dealership changes here. And finally, Joe, let's talk about food. Let's talk about pizza and about another pizzeria that is relocating from out of state to Indiana. Tell us about Uno and where they're going to be located.
Yes, people know for many years we had the Uno by the South Lake Mall. That unfortunately closed to make way for the Chick-fil-A, but Uno is back. And it's part of this deep dish corridor that's been kind of created now in Highland and Highland and Cherryville along Indianapolis Boulevard. You already have the Giordano's at the Crossroads of America intersection, and Lua Malnati's opened a couple years ago, and just down the street in Cherryville. Now Uno's is coming back to where the former Zoop was, in front of Meyer on Indianapolis Boulevard in Highland. It's going to be mainly kind of a they'll likely have some dine-in, but it's like a smaller, it's not like one of the big dine-in restaurants that they used to have. It's more like Lua Malnati's. It's a smaller place. It's kind of most likely going to be focused on takeout and delivery. They're obviously one of the more iconic Chicago pizzeria brands. Though oddly, like unlike a lot of the other ones that are known for the deep dish, they only have the Pizzeria Uno and the Pizzeria Do about a block apart in the downtown Chicago. They don't have the extensive footprint like Lou Malnati's or Giordano's across the area. And they are actually based in Boston, strangely enough. I guess they were acquired by a Boston-based company a few years ago. They have a pretty big presence in New England especially, but they're across New England in the Midwest. They've been growing through franchising. You know, it's a company that's had its ups and downs. They did have a bankruptcy. They had a contraction. The South Lake store closed. But one of the interesting things I discovered while researching this is apparently, I mean, you have the big Chicago, New York endless debate over, you know, who's got the better pizza. There are apparently more Uno pizzerias in New York City than there are in Chicago. So I just thought that was an interesting side note, because they really staked their growth, like, kind of bringing Chicago-style pizza to the rest of the country. That's been their big their big strategy, but they're going to be back in Northwest Indiana. They're looking at opening in another like week or two in early June there. And they've been hiring and kind of ramping up their operations. But, you know, a lot of people are looking forward to seeing them come back because another deep dish option. And of course they also have the tavern style pizza that some people claim. A lot of people claim, you know, deep dish is for the tourists, the tavern style square cut pizza. That's the real Chicago pizza. They'll have that, multiple varieties, as well as, you know, appetizers and all the, you know, food you're used to at Uno's.
Well, it certainly sounds, Joseph, like it's another opportunity to look for some great food. And in this case, it's something outside of the Loop or the River North area, to be sure, in Chicago, with Uno coming into Northwest Indiana, to be sure. And as always, Joe, thank you for joining us on the program today with the stories that you've put out there in print and online.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Joseph Pete. He's a reporter, covers business and a few other stories as well for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Network Indiana's State House Bureau reporter Eric Berman for his comments, to Post Tribune freelance reporter Carol Carlson, and to Times of Northwest Indiana business reporter Joseph Pete for the stories they've put together and put out in print and online. And we thank you for joining us on the program today, and we'll be back with you on Tuesday.